You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
It is Tuesday, the 16th of January. Talking Indians baseball today with our good friend Jordan Bastian, Indians reporter for MLB.com. Jordan, as always, we thank you for the time. We'll touch on a few different topics today. The MLB pipeline prospects list is being unveiled this week. Our good friends Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo, hard at work 24/7, 365 and compiling that list, and we'll see what Indians farmhands are going to make the cut. But first and foremost, just want to start off by kind of diving into the inbox. Some fans having some questions for you about the state of the 2018 Indians and the status of certain players, given some health issues and whatnot, and some players that, in the eyes of some fans, Jordan, may have gotten away. In particular, want to talk about Jay Bruce to get your take on him. He was such a perfect fit being acquired from the Mets at the deadline. He was a huge part of that 22-game winning streak towards the tail end of that streak. Had a walk-off double, I believe, in one of the games that got him to, I believe at the time, 19 or 20 wins. So he was just such a perfect fit for this team. Obviously, he's back with the Mets, signing with them in free agency at 3 years and $39 million. And I know that a lot of fans are saying, you know, gosh, for, you know, only $13 million a year, we could have had this guy back. He was such a good fit. And I know that some fans, you know, a second layer to this is that they kind of bemoan the fact that the Indians brought back Michael Brantley, so injury-prone, and they didn't get back Jay Bruce, who again, was just so good. But you had a good breakdown on Indians.com about, you know, why there's a little more than meets the eye when it comes to the Brantley and Bruce debate, and how they're not totally dissimilar, despite the fact that, you know, Brantley's had the health issues and Bruce put up some great numbers. But when healthy, they're not that far apart. So kind of break down for us, you know, why the decision was made on Brantley, why it was not made on Bruce, and again, just, you know, how similar these two players really are.
Yeah, I mean, fans really took to Bruce right away. I mean, and it was also an aggressive trade at the time for the Indians to get him. And at the time, the Indians were without both Michael Brantley and Lonnie Chisenhall. So acquiring Bruce was, you know, not only a big move for the Indians, but it was opportunistic and, you know, and filled a need at the time. You know, as the Indians sit here today, they're expecting to have Brantley ready for, you know, hopefully most of the season. He's still recovering from an ankle surgery, but they're hopeful that he can be ready for opening day or maybe a little bit into the early portion of the season. And Lonnie Chisenhall is going to be back and healthy, ready for opening day, presumably, you know, unless anything happens this spring. But so they have the guys that were down at the time when they acquired Bruce. So that's part of the equation. As far as picking up Michael Brantley's team option for $12 million, I mean, this was a decision they had to make right away, you know, right out of the chute when the World Series ended. You know, they had a few days to go over. They had a few days to, you know, and the October period to sort of analyze the free agent market, project what guys might make, project what Michael Brantley's value would be. And when you really look at what Brantley's production was, the $12 million asking price for 1 year, it's actually pretty good value. That where it gets complicated for the Indians is they didn't have a ton of monetary wiggle room. So even though $12 million is good value for Brantley, that actually kind of hinders what they could do financially the rest of the way this winter. But you got to remember, at the time, free agency hadn't opened yet. Jay Bruce and Carlos Santana, who the Indians also lost in free agency, I mean, those were among the guys who were hitting the open market and expecting to get big paydays. And I think Jay Bruce was anticipating getting a larger contract than he wound up getting with the Mets. And right now, if you look at the number of outfielders that are still unsigned, I mean, this market has developed very, very slowly. I think the Indians at the time of that decision were saying, we need, you know, we could either lock a guy in now or you inherit all the risk of the offseason of not knowing. You don't know at the time that you pick up Brantley that Jay Bruce is going to sign for $1 million more annually. You know, you think he might be making more money. Anyways, so that sort of played into it, the timeline of it. The other aspect is if you really break down what they did, Brantley had a shortened season, so that's obviously a lot of risk there. You're going forward knowing that there's injury risk, but you're only having it on a one-year deal. What Jay Bruce did over the course of all of last season, while he had more power, he had 30-plus homers and had the 500-plus slugging, they're not very different players in terms of their overall value. Brantley just gets there in a different way. He's more of a high-contact type hitter, a lot more consistency, a guy that is more known for hitting close to 300 and having a good on base. maybe not the same type of slugging, but kind of at the end of the day, when you add up all their numbers, they kind of project to be around the same type of guy. I think last year I broke down, Bruce had a higher WAR, but if you look at WAR per games played, Bruce was 0.184 and Brantley was 0.178, like almost identical. Yeah. And you're looking at a slugger going into his age 31, 32, 33 years with Bruce, and you're looking at Brantley who has the risk of injury. And now you've avoided a long-term commitment and you've rolled the dice on a short-term commitment. And on top of that, when you look at the next free agent class for the Indians, they potentially have Cody Allen, Andrew Miller, Michael Brantley, Josh Tomlin, Lonnie Chisenhall, Zach McAllister, potentially Brandon Guyer, depending on his option. You have all these guys potentially becoming free agents next year when the Indians are going to have to look at their financial situation and prioritize. You know, they might have to replace Miller and Allen in the bullpen. Well, that's going to cost money. Just look at what relievers are getting this year. So by committing a shorter-term deal to Brantley, you're also freeing up maybe some more finances next year to try and guard against all those other holes that you might have to fill to keep this window open for this Indians team.
And Jordan, when you look at the state of baseball right now, you know the freshest thing in people's minds is the World Series, which was a glorified home run derby at times. So you've got that in your mind. And there's so much emphasis now on launch angle and getting the ball in the air and consequently hitting home runs. Is that why do you think that in the eyes of many fans, not all, but many, that Bruce was a more appealing option than Brantley?
Oh, for sure. I mean, everyone loves, chicks dig the long ball, right?
Of course.
That old commercial with Greg Maddux. Yeah, we all love that.
And most dudes do too nowadays, so let's be honest.
Yeah, people love home runs. But, I mean, you can look at – I can't think of his numbers off the top of my head, but I think a guy last year – like Rougned Odor. I think he hit 30-plus home runs. When you looked at his weighted runs created plus or his OPS plus, he was well below league average in terms of hitting. Now, it's not fair to really compare him to Bruce because Bruce was an above-average hitter. He had a 115 OPS plus, which means he was 15% better than league average last year. So this guy was a guy who sort of bought into the fly ball revolution and did it effectively. So it's not to say you don't want to clump him in with guys that are hitting 30 home runs and are below average. He doesn't really fit into that category. But I do think from a fan's perspective, you're right, that a lot of fans see 30 home runs and think we're losing a 30 home run hitter without sort of considering the full offensive picture. I was talking to a front office executive earlier this winter just about how within front offices and even within fans' mindsets, you almost have to shift what you've known about home runs. Like when we were kids, if a guy hit 30 home runs, like you sort of knew what that meant. Mm-hmm. Where now, if a guy hits 30 home runs, it means something totally different.
Yeah.
A guy like Francisco Lindor, I think years ago, you wouldn't have imagined a shortstop of his build and his defensive talents. And you wouldn't have imagined him being a 30 home run hitter. But in the environment that the game is today, he is a 30 home run hitter, but so are a lot of other players.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said it perfectly. When we were kids, if a guy hit 30 home runs in a season, it was like, wow. That was a magical, mythical number. And for a guy to get
now
to 30.
Now you're going, why aren't you hitting 30
yes,
home runs?
Yeah. If you don't have 30 by the All-Star break, you're slumping. You're having a bad year. So that's just the era we're in. But, great explanation as to why, Bruce is the sexier option between himself and Brantley. But we've seen Brantley, when healthy, how good he can be. A top three MVP finisher not that all that long ago. And if he gets back to full health, no reason to think he can't reach those heights again. Jordan, shifting gears here. The Indians and Twins are going to play a few games in Puerto Rico during the regular season. That comes up in mid-April following the Indians' first traditional homestand at Progressive Field. Talk about how this kind of came about, and obviously a lot of players on the Indian squad, natives of Puerto Rico, and how much this means to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think MLB, it's been pretty clear in recent years they're trying to expand the international reach, and this series wasn't a response to the hurricane. I mean, they had this thing planned ahead of time, and now it just sort of becomes almost a celebration of the island's recovery. And I think guys like Roberto Perez and Francisco Lindor, and the players from the Twins who hail from Puerto Rico, they're really looking forward to this. I've talked to Roberto Perez a few times this winter because his mother lost her house in the storm on the western coast of the island. And so he's been back and forth between Puerto Rico and Cleveland this winter, you know, talking to her about building her a new home. And, you know, that was the home he grew up in, and he, you know, how fortunate he feels to be in a position to help his own family. But now also he feels fortunate to be a part of this series, which can sort of put Puerto Rico in the spotlight and show the recovery. And, you know, I was just there on a vacation. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't there touring the stadium or anything like that. But in my trip there and my week spent, you know, I talked to a lot of people, you know, along my trip, you know, just in restaurants and cabs. And, you know, every single one of them, it seemed like, knew somebody that was still without power. You know, I talked to one man who really praised the public response in the aftermath of the storm, and how many people have been coming down to Puerto Rico to help out, and, you know, how many people have been putting together funds. And, you know, we saw, you know, a lot of buildings that were still, you know, boarded up and next to buildings that were being rebuilt. And I mean, it was really something to be down there to see it firsthand. And I think we're talking about a series that's, you know, a couple months from now, it's going to be an even better situation. Yadier Molina actually had a charity event in early December. 20,000 people packed that stadium, and I think over 200,000 was raised for hurricane relief funds. So a lot of positive things are coming out of a very big negative thing. And I think this series, this two-game series of the Twins, is just going to be a continuation of that in April.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And we cannot overlook just how much work there is left to be done, just how much devastation that area endured through the hurricanes. But as you said, the recovery effort is ongoing. And, you know, hopefully this is going to be a celebration not only of baseball, but of that recovery effort come mid-April. And I just can't wait to see the enthusiasm and the excitement we're going to see from the fans in the stands, because we know how much they love their baseball down there. To have some of their native sons back on the field and playing meaningful games, it's going to be a wonderful experience all the way around. Jordan, to come down the home stretch here, as I said at the top of the podcast, the MLB Pipeline Prospects list is soon to be unveiled a bit later on this week. And tell us some of the names that Indians fans can expect to see on that list of some guys that hopefully are not too far away from making it to the show.
Yeah, I think the guy that came out on the first list was the top 10 right-handed pitchers. He was ranked ninth. It was Tristan McKenzie. He's a pretty exciting young right-handed pitcher for the Indians. 20 years old now, first rounder a few years ago for the Tribe. And last year, you know, he sort of advanced from a two-pitch mix to working on a developing changeup, and logged 143 innings, struck out 186 batters, had a 3.46 ERA, and did so with a full season at Class A Advanced Lynchburg. So this is a guy that, you know, for his minor league career is averaging over 11 strikeouts per nine inning, great strikeout to walk ratio. Is really showing that blend of power and precision. And this is a tall, lanky kid that still has a lot of room to grow physically. And he's very young for the leagues he's been. I think he was almost 4 years younger than the average player in the Carolina League. So he's a really exciting guy that, when you look at this rotation now, you know, Kluber, Carrasco, Bauer, these guys that were acquired in various ways, developed, and have sort of led to this period of success. Well, when you start forecasting to, you know, how are the Indians going to sort of maintain this reputation and sustain the success, a guy like Tristan McKenzie looks like a big building block. And, you know, as the other lists come out, we'll see what happens. But I think catcher Francisco Mejia is pretty much a lock to be included in the top catchers, maybe arguably the top catcher in baseball. And then another guy that I think could make the list among first basemen is Bobby Bradley, who's a young power hitter within the Indians system, and will be in spring training with the team along with Mejia this year coming up. So, a lot of young prospects coming up. It's, you know, last couple of years you've seen guys graduate to the big leagues, guys like Bradley Zimmer a few years ago, Tyler Naquin, Lindor before them. You've sort of seen the building blocks coming up through the system and now becoming cornerstones in the big leagues. And, you know, it's kind of fun to watch how these guys develop. So a guy like Mejia, a guy like McKenzie, those are guys that definitely going to be fun to monitor this season.
No question. The present looks bright. Obviously, in the future, not too shabby as well from the sounds of things. The full lists are coming out later this week, courtesy of MLB Pipeline MLB.com. That puts a bow tie on this one, Mr. Bastian. We thank you, as always, for the time, and we'll do it again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians. It is Wednesday, the 17th of January. We're talking White Sox baseball today with none other than Scott Merkin, our White Sox reporter for MLB.com. Scott, as always, we thank you for the time. We'll touch on a few different things in this podcast. We'll talk about Michael Kopech, the number three right-handed pitching prospect, according to our friends at MLBPipeline.com. We'll touch on him. We'll touch on some of the goings-on at minicamp right now, a lot of the highly touted youngsters in attendance. But want to start here. The White Sox may have two players go to arbitration. Those players could be Avi Garcia and Yoimer Sanchez, and the White Sox have not gone to arbitration with any player since 2001, and that was with Keith Foulk, and Foulk won his arbitration case. So, Scott, give us the breakdown here. What are the chances that at least one of these players does go to arbitration? How far apart are the two sides? What's going on here?
Well, they're both pretty close, but as far as I know, unless they've changed it, and I don't think they have, they're not a file and trial type of team. You know, some teams where if it gets to arbitration, they automatically go, you know, to the situation. But the Sox will still continue talking to these guys. I would guess, though, that if they don't take the Sox offer, it's probably going to go to arbitration, which has been interesting because, like I said, and you just mentioned, they've been able to avoid that for going on 17 years now. The last time they went, Keith Foulk, who I don't know if he was I think he was the closer at that point, beat the White Sox. And that was the most recent trial they had coming 1 year after they won the division in 2000, won the AL Central. But yes, yeah, so I don't, it's hard to say. It's hard, you know, Sanchez is very close. I can't think of the exact terms, but they're like a couple hundred, you know, just a little bit apart. Garcia's a little more. Garcia asked for over six, and I think they came in around 5'8". So it's hard to guess right now, but I think talks will continue. And if they go, then they'll have to, you know, move from there. It's an interesting process, not always the, I don't want to say most pleasant, but you know, a team is fighting for what they offer, and the player is fighting for what they want. So it's kind of, you know, at cross purposes for most of the time. You know, both sides getting along, and that side they're kind of a little bit of adversaries, it seems like.
Yeah, it's an odd dynamic for sure, and that kind of leads into my next topic. My next question is that can there be some lingering, you know, bad or awkward feelings between a player and between team management, you know, going into a season? Because, again, on one hand, you understand it's a business and the player's trying to do right by him and his family and the people he supports, and, of course, the team is trying to do right by their business structure. And, you know, again, both sides understand that. But, again, there are emotions and personal feelings that go into this. So, you know, again, in cases that you've seen, can there be some lingering bad feelings that may persist throughout the year?
I think there certainly can be. I don't think there will be in this instance. You're talking about two of the more upbeat guys on the White Sox. You know, Garcia is coming off his, you know, career year and all – not career year, his career best year, I should say. They're hoping it's not a career year. You know, an all-star effort and – real good natured guy. And Yoimer Sanchez is probably, you know, he would be the kind of the life of the party guy in the clubhouse. So I don't think there's going to be any kind of lingering effects. I think they know what the situation is. They couldn't work out something beforehand. They had, I think, four other players who they did sign, agree to 1 year deals with. And then Danny Farquhar, who was also arbitration eligible earlier in the off season. So, you know, like you said, it's the nature of the business. And I really don't believe there'll be any, you know, kind of negative effects that come from these two cases if they do go to arbitration.
Yeah, and like you said, these are probably the two most upbeat guys in that clubhouse, so that works in everybody's favor and a situation to keep an eye on in the coming week or two. Scott, let's talk about minicamp now. And I got to be honest, when I saw the features on the website about minicamp, I think minicamp, for most sports fans, is a term you associate with football. It's not really something you associate with baseball, but these, you know, these do exist. They do happen, and of course, it's happening with the White Sox right now. So, talk about, you know, the typical attendee at a mini camp. I imagine it's skewed towards the younger players on the team, the prospects trying to, you know, break through and get a big league spot. And talk about how this kind of differentiates from spring training in terms of, you know, an agenda, what you do, what you work on, what you want to accomplish.
Yeah, I can point out one thing. We're talking about the arbitration cases. Yoimer Sanchez is out there at Camelback Ranch working out, and he wasn't even part of the minicamp. He's kind of a little more advanced, I think, and he's there on his own, just kind of working with the team. So that gives an idea of his demeanor and his, you know, upbeat attitude. But I think you hit it on the head when you talked about football, because I know, like, in Chicago, we'll hear about the Bears draft picks, well, you know, attending a rookie mini camp at Hallis Hall out in Lake Forest, Illinois, right after, you know, shortly after the draft. And while these aren't, you know, all rookie, these are not rookies. These are top prospects. They've gotten together with a few veterans in there. You know, Matt Davidson is out there. Omar Narváez is out there. Kevin Smith is out there. There's some non-roster guys who are more on the, you know, a little more veteran out there. But, you know, it's they've done it for a few years now, and it kind of gives them a checkpoint to see where, you know, the hitters are and kind of get their eyes and hands on them and see, you know, what they need to work on going towards spring training. Remember, spring training is a little earlier this year, too, because the season starts a little earlier also. So, you know, the mini camp's a little closer, I think, to where the season is than it was in years past. But also, you know, this was the United States debut of Luis Robert, who played, you know, was the Cuban international free agent they signed for, you know, $26 million bonus in the, you know, international market there. He played for the Dominican Summer League team last year. He was in Dominican Instructional League in November. So this is the first time he's played baseball over the United States. He was in Chicago for his press conference to announce his signing. And he's there. Eloy Jimenez is there. Yoan Moncada is there. So, you know, Jake Berger is there. Gavin Sheets, the top two picks in last year's draft for the Sox. So it's kind of, you know, get a look at the elite guys. And it's you know, all offense, and see where they're going and see what they have to do in the next few weeks going into spring training when things go full boat. So, you know, I think it's going a week long, which is a little longer than it has in the past. But, you know, some interesting things. You know, Jesse Sanchez has had a chance to talk to Robber and Moncada and Jimenez out there. I had a talk with Adam Engel, and he's out there also. And just kind of some interesting scenarios building up and how tight this group is growing already in just a short time they've been together.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, like you said, to have these young guys together in one place at the same time, you can create that bond, because I think these guys know the situation that, you know, they expect to be the core, the nucleus of this team for years to come, and they're going to be the guys that get the White Sox back in contention, hopefully on an annual basis, and to have this time to kind of get to know each other and bond and grow together and learn together and even make mistakes together can only be a good thing going forward. Scott, I want to get your take on Michael Kopech. He was recently named the number three right-handed pitching prospect in the farm system, in all farm systems, not just the White Sox, according to MLBPipeline.com. Now, the speculation on Kopech is that he's probably not going to open camp with the team. He's not going to be on the opening day roster, but I think at some point he is going to crack that rotation. So what kind of a timetable are we looking at for Kopech? We've heard all the tall tales about him. You know, he can consistently throwing at triple digits, his strikeout numbers off the charts. So White Sox fans excited. When can we see him at U.S. Cellular?
Yeah, I said this before. I think when you trade a guy like Chris Sale, who's one of the, you know, best, maybe, you know, in the team picture of the best four or five starting pitchers in baseball, and also a good clubhouse guy with a team too, you better get something great in return. And they have, you know, at the front is Yoan Moncada, starting second baseman, and now Kopech, who could be a top of the rotation guy for years to come. I think when you're looking at his season this year, I talked recently to pitching coach Don Cooper, and he said they're going to use him as a starter in spring training, and they're going to give a lot of these young guys chances to be seen. But, you know, let's be realistic. I think he's probably going to, he's only made, I think, three starts at Charlotte last year, so he's probably going to get a little time at Charlotte before coming to the Sox. I would think study the path that kind of Ronaldo Lopez traveled last year, where he, I think, made 22 starts for Charlotte before coming up and making 7 or 8 for the White Sox. Kopech may make a few more. Lopez battled an injury when he was up at the White Sox and missed like 3 weeks, I want to say. So I think similar to that, you'll see Kopech in the major leagues. Remember this year, you know, again, they're not trying to lose. These players want to win. These players want to play well. These players want to, you know, speed up the process of rebuild. But this is more of a developmental year, so they're still not looking to be prime contenders, as they will be starting next year and every year moving forward after that. So there's no rush. That's one of the, I've said this a number of times on the podcast and wrote this a number of times in stories. One of the great things they've done is they're not bringing up guys just to bring up guys and say, hey, here's Moncada, here's Kopech. When they're up, they're confident these guys are going to stay for a while. And I think that's what they're looking for Kopech. And that's why you'll see him pitch a little bit for Charlotte before, you know, maybe more than a little bit, pitch you know, start the season and make some starts part of the Knights rotation before he gets to the White Sox.
Yeah, you could say that, you know, 2018, by and large, a lot of these guys in the organization as a whole, playing with house money, you know, you want to win, obviously, but if you don't, no one's going to begrudge you for it because of the state that the franchise is in. You get these young guys up there, get them some experience, get their feet wet, and then, like you said, in 2019 and beyond, that's when you can seriously start contemplating being a contender and seeing these guys come into their own.
I was going to say real quickly, you don't know how quickly they'll progress. You know, maybe Moncada makes a huge step this year. Maybe Luis Robert, who has been just lighting it up and impressing everyone at the minicamp, gets to the majors earlier, or Jimenez does too, and maybe, you know, they really do make some kind of run at, let's say, the second wild card or a wild card without changing the plan at hand. So you never know. Like you said, it's house money, and you go with what you stick with the plan and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, they could be this year's Brewers. You know, I mean, nobody expected the Brewers in 2017 to do as well as they did. They're in a rebuilding process of their own. They were, you know, contending for that second wild card up till the next to last day of the season. Maybe that's the White Sox in 2018. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, then okay, you stick with the plan and see what you got for 2019 and beyond. Scott, to wrap up here, Miguel Gonzalez back at a one-year deal, and you know, a guy that's he's a veteran, he's trusted, he's consistent. The numbers don't jump off the page, but I think would you agree his main value is going to be as a, you know, something as a mentor to some of the younger guys that are going to be joining this rotation before long?
Yeah, I think, you know, both, you hear stories from younger pitchers about, you know, the mentor attitude shown by both James Shields, who is, you know, there already, and Miguel Gonzalez. But I think also Miguel Gonzalez, when he's on, and he was on, you know, a good portion of last year, there was a stretch of 8 or 9 starts where he was kind of pitching through a little bit of soreness where he was not very good, but otherwise he's been fine for the White Sox. And he's a good, you know, veteran pitcher to put in there. You can get 6-7 innings from the guy, you know, and not jeopardize the bullpen while helping the younger kids. It was, you know, the price is right for both sides. And, you know, when they traded him last year, I don't think the Sox necessarily wanted to lose him, and I don't think Gonzalez wanted to leave the White Sox. So it made total sense that this was a guy they targeted and brought back, you know, to fill out the rotation, especially with Carlos Rodon uncertain when he will be officially back as part of the White Sox.
Yeah, a good safety net to have in the form of Miguel Gonzalez for sure. Scott, great stuff as always. We will get more mini camp updates next week and see what else is going on in the land of the Pale Hose. So Scott Merkin, thanks for your time. We'll do it again soon. And in the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras Chicago White Sox. On this 19th of January, a Friday afternoon, we're talking Tigers baseball today with Jason Beck, our Tigers reporter for MLB.com. Jason, as always, we thank you for the time. And I want to touch on a couple of topics today, as obviously it's no secret by this point. The Tigers are rebuilding, and their future hinges on some of the marquee prospects they got in return for dealing some veterans last season in 2017, most notably J.D. Martinez and Justin Verlander. So we're going to get your take on the developments this season of both Joel Lugo and Jake Rogers as well. Also dive into the inbox a little bit to see if the Tigers may take a flyer on a kind of a low-risk veteran to stabilize that rotation. I want to start off by talking about Mr. Lugo and Mr. Rogers. We'll talk about Joel Lugo first, as, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. The baseball world is still awaiting, where the heck is J.D. Martinez going to sign? Is he going to be a Red Sox? Is he going to return to Arizona? But the Tigers have done their part. They dealt him at his highest value. They got some great prospects in return. I think the centerpiece of that deal was the aforementioned Joel Lugo. A lot of eyes are going to be on him this year. In what ways do you think the Tigers are hoping he continues his development as he continues his pursuit of a big league spot?
Well, I think they're hoping that he can continue to hit for some power and become more of an offensive impact player. That's really what they're missing more than anything in this farm system now are impact hitters who can help that offense along more so than pitching by far. And when you watch Lugo, when he's on, the ball jumps off his bat and he connects at a pretty good rate. So now the question is doing it consistently and also adjusting to more veteran starters, which, you know, you get a taste of that in AAA because you have more of those minor league free agents who float around for a lot of years, guys with better secondary stuff than maybe the younger pitchers you're more likely to see in AA.
Absolutely, and it's kind of a tricky thing, I think, for front offices sometimes when you are tracking the development of a prospect, a hitting prospect in particular, because the saying goes that power is always the last tool to develop. You can hone your on-base skills and your strike zone recognition skills and all the other attributes that go with that, but power is the one thing that, you know, it may take some guys some time to really, you know, come into their own in terms of hitting the ball over the fence. So is that kind of where the Tigers are at, where they say, okay, you know, we want to see a little more pop, we want to see the home run numbers increase, but if they don't, this guy is still so young that it's not something to get that upset about. Is that kind of the tricky middle ground that they're in right now?
Yeah, I think that's some of it. I think you've seen that in other guys who have come up through the system. Not that there's been a ton of those guys in recent years, but you know, Nick Castellanos did not hit for a ton of power his first year or two up, even though he clearly was a strong guy at the plate. It didn't translate into a whole lot of home runs, despite a really good line drive rate. That's really come in times. He's learned his approach and kind of gotten comfortable with himself as a hitter and gotten comfortable with plate discipline and making more consistent, strong contact. So it's a balance the Tigers are striking because they need offense in the worst way. That's really where the bulk of this rebuilding effort's going to be focused, because they have a lot of pitching already in the system that's going to be making its way up. On the other hand, they're looking for athletic-type players who can fit the profile of Comerica Park. You know, big ballpark where if you've got guys who can run, you can really take advantage of those gaps and get a lot of doubles and triples out of it. Well, you need some power hitters to go with that. And that's where guys like Lugo come in. That's where, you know, a guy like Isaac Grady, so I think we talked about last week or the week before, comes in. And that's where Christian Stewart, who I'm going to be writing about soon, also, you know, comes into play. They need those guys who can send the ball out of the ballpark.
Absolutely. And, you know, like you said earlier, if the home run power isn't there yet, if the loft is not there on the swing, you do want to see, you know, the great line drive rate. You want to see the good exit velocity. And more times than not, if you have those assets in your favor and you continue to develop in that way, then the home run power is going to come. So I think there's a more sophisticated approach these days in evaluating young hitters where, you know, it's not the be-all, end-all whether or not they're hitting home runs. It's those other stat cast attributes about, you know, hard hit rate, line drive rate, exit velocity, and then you can assess what type of hitter somebody's going to become. And, you know, hopefully Lugo does reach the heights that are expected of him. Of course, time will tell, as is so often the case. Jason, the other guy I want to focus on, too, is the main return in the Justin Verlander deal to the Astros at literally the last second last year in August. That would be catcher Jake Rogers. He was well within the top 10 catching prospects in the game, according to our friends at MLBpipeline.com. Still just 22, but I know that they rave about him defensively especially. Would you say that he's a little more advanced defensively right now than offensively? And then the part B of that question is, could we maybe expect a cup of coffee from him at some point in 2018, or do you think his arrival is still a little more of a ways off, maybe 2019?
Well, when the Tigers acquired him in that Verlander trade, he definitely came over with a reputation as a defense-first catcher. I haven't seen him play in person yet. I'm looking forward to kind of getting a look at him in the spring training coming up. But you know, the strong arm, it really goes back to his reputation in college. And one reason why he was drafted as high as he was by the Astros was they felt like he could really do a lot behind the plate more so than at the plate. He's come along a little ways at the plate as a hitter over the last year and a half. So, and they're hoping that, you know, that could continue. I think how that come along could really dictate whether he's seen as an everyday catcher or if he ends up being a platoon guy. But they really like the idea of him being able to eventually come in and take a role, whether it's replacing James McCann or complementing him, depending on what the long-term plans go on with McCann and how the rebuild goes. I'd be surprised if you see him this coming season. I think it would take some injuries because, you know, the Tigers are pretty well set behind the play in Detroit right now, not just with McCann and John Hicks, but you know, they also brought in Derek Morris and Brian Pena on non-roster invites. They have another catching prospect who's going to be most likely opening in Triple-A Toledo in Grayson Griner, who they like a lot, a guy who also is a pretty good defensive reputation, strong arm, you know, pretty good athletic agility for somebody his size. You're talking about like a 6'5", 6'6", catcher, which seems pretty rare. It's almost like watching Joe Mauer with a little bit better defense. But I think they're going to take their time with Rodgers, partly to because they can, because they have the depth, but also partly because I think they want to give him a chance to get comfortable hitting-wise and see some of the same pitchers full time through and get a full season and a half at the plate before he comes up and fights for a spot in Detroit.
Yeah, and there's some parallels between him and Joel Lugo that we just discussed, you know, whereas with hitting prospects, the power is kind of that last tool to develop. With catching prospects, it's the defense. It's the game calling. It's the throwing out base runners. So if those attributes are there at such a young age, as they seem to be for Rodgers, who's just 22 years of age, then I think that, the upside and the potential is certainly there, because not that hitting is a skill you learn overnight, but I think that, again, with catching prospects, the defense comes along more slowly than the offense, but the defense is there for him if he can become a slightly above average better hitter, then he's going to be an asset in the major leagues for many years to come. Let's dive into the inbox a little bit in these last few minutes. Jason, a number of fans questioning whether the team may take a flyer on a low-risk starter, a guy that's been around, a veteran, to maybe stabilize this rotation a little bit behind the guys like Fulmer and Norris and such. Do you see that happening? Do you see them reaching out there and maybe getting a guy that can just have some that can add some veteran presence to this very young rotation?
I think they're open to doing it. In fact, I think they'd like to do it, but it's got to be on their terms. I wrote that it seems a little bit less likely that they do anything as far as like maybe a guaranteed contract. But I think they'd like to do maybe like a non-roster invite or two to bring some guys in to compete. And I think that looked difficult at best to envision, I think, when the offseason started. I think we kind of figured that they would have to do some guaranteed contracts to pull that off to get the guys in that they wanted. But the longer the slow free agent market goes on and the more starters you kind of see waiting for things to come together, the more you can see a scenario where a guy trying to get a rebound and turn their careers back around could end up being willing to accept a spot like that. The advantage you have, I think, when you're in a situation like the Tigers, too, is you're more likely to get guys like that on non-roster fights because they look at the roster and they see an easier path to earn a big league spot. It's something the Tigers had in 2003, 2004, where you were able to get a lot of guys on minor league deals because they felt like that even if they didn't make the team out of spring training, that given the struggles, that it would be up there eventually as long as they did their part in AAA. So I think that's the path I can see the Tigers taking to get a little bit more pigeon-proof. I know general manager Al Avila's emphasized that they need to have depth in starters, and they don't have quite the same level of that they did last year. And with some guys gone and some other guys out of options, they have to protect themselves against injuries, against inconsistencies with guys like Daniel Morris and Matthew Boyd, and against the possibility of trades down there.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, rebuilding does have its advantages where a veteran can say, you know what, I can step into this situation. I know I'm going to get my starts. I'm going to get my innings. I'm going to get my appearances because, you know, there is an opportunity for me. Whereas with other teams, if they're kind of set in their pitching ranks, it'd be tougher to kind of, you know, crack that rotation or crack that bullpen. But the Tigers, at least, you know, to some extent, not exactly in that position. Maybe there is a spot. Maybe there's some innings to be eaten up by a veteran, and we'll see what develops in the coming weeks. Good place to wrap it up for this Friday with Jason Beck. Jason, we thank you as always for the time, and we'll do it again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers. We're talking Royals baseball today on this Friday, January the 19th, with our good friend Jeffrey Flanagan, Royals reporter for MLB.com. Jeffrey, we thank you for the time, and kind of a light week in news for the Royals, but they did make an addition to their front office, a man that's been in baseball for literally over a half century. I believe that Gene Lamont is going into year 54 in professional baseball. He has a resume that is the envy of almost anybody. But following a dozen seasons as the third base coach and bench coach of the Tigers, he's now moving into a front office role alongside Dayton Moore. What exactly, you know, tell us what you know or how much you know about what Gene Lamont is going to be doing and the kind of role that he's going to have alongside the Royals GM.
Yeah, I always like to kid Dayton that I think he leads the league in special assistance to the general manager. Dayton's always been a guy that when you get a mind, an experienced baseball mind such as Gene Lamont is available, he's going to scoop him up, and that was the case this time with Gene, who was not retained in Detroit. And I spoke to Gene on I guess it was Monday, and he still wasn't quite sure what his role would be. He's probably going to overlook some minor league guys, maybe see some major league games too, but just kind of be, you know, an ear for Dayton Moore too, and for interesting too for Gene is kind of circling back home. He got his start managing in the Royals farm system back in their glory days in the 70s and 80s, and we had a nice chat about some of the, you know, guys that he was managing back then, the David Cones, Mark Gubiza, Danny Jackson, Brett Saberhagen, some of the great names in Royals history, and he got a chance to help them develop, and here he is all the way back to where he started. So 54 years in baseball, not quite ready to hang it up, but he did tell me too that he's kind of I would say a little bit relieved that he's not going to be back on the field anymore. He just feels it's time to turn the page, and now he'll just offer his wisdom to the front office here.
Now, that's interesting you say that, because it sounds like that, like you said, with the change in managers in Detroit, going from Brad Ausmus to Ron Gardenhire, that Gene Lamont was not retained. But you're saying that even if he was, he had designs of kind of stepping away from his on-field duties. Is that kind of how it worked out?
Yeah, I think so. I think at 71, he just thought, well, it's probably time to get off the field. So he was probably looking for some type of advisory role, and this opportunity opened, and it's perfect for him.
Absolutely. And any sort of pre-existing relationship between Dayton Moore and Gene Lamont specifically, or was this kind of a cold call between, you know, the two sides to get him on board?
You know, I asked Gene that too, and you know, he's good friends with Rafael Belliard, who has a relationship with the Royals now, and they used to speak with Dayton occasionally on the field when Detroit came to town, and obviously they knew each other, but they weren't really, you know, close or anything like that. And some dialogue just started to exist after Gene knew he wasn't coming back to Detroit. And, you know, Dayton made it work out. And, you know, he's happy about it, and Gene's happy about it. And here we are. The Royals have another really sharp baseball guy in the system.
And you can never have too many of those. So it sounds like a perfect fit with Gene Lamont back with the Royals organization alongside Dayton Moore in the front office. And we'll see how that relationship develops throughout the 2018 season and hopefully for both sides beyond 2018. Jeffrey, I know that last week you gave us an update on the recovery, the status of Ned Yost. It seems like that he's kind of doing all the things that he was doing prior to that near-fatal fall. So it sounds like he's bounced back. It was just a minor hiccup in the road, a minor hurdle, and he's back to living life the way that he was accustomed to doing before he landed in the hospital. One thing I want to ask you, though, kind of a fun exercise here. You know, let's go to opening day at Kauffman Stadium, you know, whoever the Royals are playing, but the team is being introduced. And let's say, for the sake of this exercise, that the Royals do end up re-signing Eric Hosmer. So, obviously, he's going to be part of those starting lineup introductions. Who gets the bigger applause? Who gets the more raucous round of applause? Is it Ned Yost or is it Eric Hosmer?
That's a toughie because of, obviously, what happened with Ned. Yeah, yes, and you're right about Ned. He's back up in tree stands already, being the nut that he is. You know, it didn't take long. We're all worried whether he would even be available for spring training, and then he let us know that, he's going to be back for Fan Fest next week, and back up fixing tree stands in my backyard or you know on my property. So. I don't know. It's going to be close. I mean, you know, there's a big love affair, of course, with Eric Hosmer, but Ned Yost brought them to two pennants and a world championship. Once maybe the most despised man in town, became one of the most beloved in Ned Yost. I think for the Royals fans' sakes, they would like to see that scenario.
No question. I know Royals fans would love to scream their lungs out on opening day for not just one of them, but both of them. We'll see, you know, what happens with Eric Hosmer. This has been the most lukewarm of hot stools we've seen in quite some time. Hosmer's still out there. J.D. Martinez, Yu Darvish, Jake Arrieta. You go down the whole list. Any update at all in terms of any sort of dialogue between Hosmer and the Royals, or is it still kind of a kind of status quo?
Yeah, I was talking to some of the Royals players about that actually this morning by phone for another story I'm doing, and they're just amazed too. I mean, you add Mike Moustakas to that list, Lorenzo Cain, Jason Vargas. It's just endless. It's been a very freaky, ice cold, hot stove off season. No real update. You know, I do know that from the people in the front office that I've talked to too that. As each day passes, and, you know, now we're less than 4 weeks out of spring training, as each day passes, they feel like there's a slightly better chance they can pull one of their own free agents back in, maybe even two. Now, that's going to take some tricky accounting for Dayton Moore to do that because he's been adamant that he needs to trim payroll. So even if they did get a guy like Hosmer, for 15 to 18 to 20 million, whatever, he's got to take that much off the payroll. So, you know, that's still got to happen. And if you're going to add another guy to it, well, he's either got to do even more tricky accounting or go to ownership and, you know, on his hands and knees and beg to, you know, let's expand the payroll a little bit. We've got an opportunity here. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I don't think they even envision this scenario unfolding where they'd still be, you know, here we go into the end of January and they're still in position to possibly maybe retain a free agent or two. So should be a very curious next couple weeks, I think. You would just think there has to be some activity going with all the names that you mentioned, too, that something's got to just, you know, break this up a little bit and get some action going.
Yeah, I mean, the dam has to break at some point. You know, who does the breaking, we don't know. But you would think at some point, you know, something does have to happen. So, from your experience in covering, you know, off seasons and free agency in years past, at what point does your average player panic and call his agent and start freaking out? Is it when the calendar turns to February? Is it when, you know, is it maybe a little closer to spring training? Like, at what point does the panic start to really set in?
You know, the guys I was talking to today have been mentioning that too, and really most players start to go to spring training around February 3rd or. And, you know, I think that's probably when players probably start calling their agent a few more times a day or texting them and go, hey, my buddies are all leaving for Arizona or Florida. Anything going on? Anything? You know, that's when I think they start to get a little bit nervous and they just don't like to be sitting around not doing anything while, you know, baseball kind of marches on. So, I would say by the beginning of February, the first week of February, these guys might take deals they might not have thought they would when free agency started. and maybe they take a one-year deal or a two-year deal or something instead of the long-term deal they were hoping. I don't know. I mean, this is kind of uncharted territory for us because I don't think we've ever had a free agency period this stalled in a long, long time with the type of big-name free agents we have on the market right now.
Yeah, I mean, usually by this point, you know, us folks in the media, we're trying to, you know, come up with projected rotations and lineups, you know, given the additions that the teams have made, but there have been no notable – there have been a couple. But for the most part, you know, we ran down all the names. There's still some huge – huge names out there, so we can't really do any projections because we don't know where these guys are going to end up. It's just crazy. Like you said, this is really unprecedented. Let me ask you to come down the home stretch here. Obviously, you know, Hosmer is the number one target. That's the guy that the team wants back. That's the primary guy the fans want back. Let's assume that he moves on somewhere else. One of the other 29 teams scoops him up. Of Vargas, Moustakas, and Kane, who do you think becomes the number one, you know, desired player to come back?
Probably Moose. I think his presence at the clubhouse is a big factor. You know, coming off a career year with 38 home runs, I think that they would love to see a guy like that come back. They do have a fill-in for him already with Chester Cuthbert, but Cuthbert could easily move somewhere else, being a DH, or maybe even if he has played some first base in the past himself. So Moose, to me, would be the logical one. If I had to rank them, you know, maybe, and we've talked about this before, Alcides Escobar is a guy that's obviously still out there too, and I don't think there's going to be a massive market for him. So possibly he could come back kind of on the cheap as a backup shortstop alternative to Raul Mondesi, who used to be their top prospect, who's going to get the shortstop job next year. And then maybe, you know, what if Vargas would be willing to accept a one-year $7 or $8 million deal? Would you bring him back 2 years removed from Tommy John surgery? So there's still a lot of, you know, of those situations in play yet. And I'm sure the front office is doing what we're doing. They're going, what if? So as we get closer and closer to spring training, these scenarios are possibly going to come to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, this entire offseason has been what if, and it's been a huge waiting game, and it's something that we have never seen, at least in recent memory. This has been a hot stove, and I use that term very loosely, unlike other hot stoves in the past. But at some point, something's got to happen. We keep hoping. We keep the fingers crossed, and maybe one of these weeks we'll have a flood of activity and moves to discuss, but that week is not this week. But Jeffrey, nonetheless, we thank you for the time and for the contributions. We'll see where it all leads. Maybe, like I said, by this time next week, something will have happened. But in the meantime, it's Matt Waymire signing off for MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals. Talking Twins baseball today on this 19th of January, a Friday afternoon, with our good friend Rhett Bollinger, Twins reporter for MLB.com. Rhett, we thank you for the time. Some cool things to discuss this week. We'll talk about a rather surprising 2-year deal to bring in Addison Reed to add to that new-look bullpen, which already includes new additions Zach Duke and Fernando Rodney. We'll talk about where Reed slots in to that new-look bullpen for the Twins here in 2018. We'll talk about the pursuits of a marquee starting pitcher. We've heard them linked to Yu Darvish. You know, might they entertain Jake Arrieta? Might they entertain Lance Lynn? We'll get your take on that. But first, I want to start off with some very notable additions to the front office. As in recent days, the Twins have added a couple of legends, Jim Cott and Justin Morneau, to the front office. And I always chuckle, you know, when moves like this are made and teams say, you know, well, he's going to be in the role of special assistant. You know, there can't be a more vague term than that. It always kind of makes me laugh. So kind of, you know, break down a little bit for us with more specificity, you know, what their special assistant roles are going to be. What's Cott going to be doing? What's Morneau going to be doing? You know, how are they really going to contribute to this Twins front office?
So they are both special assistants, as you said. I think the big difference is that Morneau is going to be more on the baseball operations side. He's going to actually do some real front office work and do some, you know, whether it's scouting or seeing on draft room stuff and, you know, helping out with, you know, free agency stuff. He's going to kind of sit on a lot of those meetings and kind of find out more, you know, about those realms. I think obviously he's getting out of baseball pretty fresh. He didn't play last year, but obviously had a great career, has a lot of insight he could offer to the front office, which is something he's wanted to do. So I think it's not just kind of, sometimes you get those jobs and it's more of a, kind of a paper title and you don't really do much. With Morneau, I think he's going to be very active. And I think one of the things, too, is he's been on the ballpark a lot. He lives here. He said that one of the things he really wanted to help out was Max Kepler, the left-handed swing in right fielder, who has a very similar swing to Morneau. I think he kind of wants to help him. Kepler had a great rookie year last year. Was a little bit more inconsistent, so I think that's kind of one of the big hopes is maybe he can work with him a little bit, even on the mental side of the game, too. So he'll be in spring training, two different stints, too, to help out as an instructor. So really, it's just good to have him around the organization, but it's a real role, though, too. He's really had some real say and some real things he'll be doing. Whereas Jim Cott's kind of more of a celebratory role. He's a special assistant to the organization, but it's going to be more, kind of community events and things like that. He'll be down in spring training as well for part of the time. And he's here at Twins Fest this weekend, which begins here today on Friday. He'll be here to meet the fans, sign some autographs, too, as well. So his role is more similar to what, Tony Oliva does and Rod Carew. And so, Ken Urbick, some guys that are more the legends of the organization that are a little bit older, that have more of a, they still have a role in terms of the community events and going on caravan, those type of things. But Morneau is going to be more kind of day-to-day and more into the grind of baseball, whereas the other role is a little bit more celebratory.
And, Red, I'm curious, Jim Cott has been a broadcaster and an outstanding one for many, many years. I and many others, I'm sure yourself too, have enjoyed hearing him on numerous broadcasts over the years. Is he giving up his broadcast duties, or is he still going to kind of do double duty with his front office role? What's the situation there?
It's a great question. I have to check in with him and see. I wouldn't be surprised if he did a few games. I've also heard some rumblings that Morneau might do a few games as well. So I think that's kind of the plan right now, is Morneau might do 10 games or so. Still not official. I think the Twins kind of want to put out a press release because they kind of mix it up a lot of times. Last year was kind of fun. They had Torii Hunter do some of the games. They had LaTroy Hawkins do some games. So from what I've heard, Morneau is going to probably do that as well. And as you said, Jim Cott's done a lot of stuff in the past with the Yankees and even the Twins back in the day and MLB Network. So you got to figure he'll probably have a role in that as well.
Yeah, and I mean, what better mentor for Justin Morneau to have than Jim Cott, because he's done this, for decades after his playing career ended. A great person to learn from when they both hopefully get behind the mic here for the 2018 season. And, right, it's not uncommon for teams to add, former legends to their front office after their playing days are done. But the Twins, it seems, lately, obviously very intent on doing this, is, again, they bring in within the course of, 4 days, Justin Morneau and Jim Cott. Is this a concerted effort on their part to kind of maintain continuity within the organization, or am I reading too much into this? Like, what's the plan here?
It definitely is. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think last year we know the big moves where they, added Torii Hunter to the organization. They added Michael Kadire and LaTroy Hawkins. They had similar roles to Morneau. They actually, same thing, they had input into free agency last year. I know Kadire was a guy that really liked Matt Belisle a lot in free agency. His teammate in Colorado, and I believe LaTroy Hawkins knew him pretty well, too, and recommended him. Sure enough, Belisle was a great addition for them as well. And those guys are all mentors, too. Torii Hunter is going to be a mentor, of course, to Byron Buxton. The same way the Twins would love to have Morneau be a mentor to Kepler. I think that it's just the organization wants to do this. I think the next few guys you might see do this could even be, Johan Santana was elected to the Twins Hall of Fame today, which is a big honor for him. But he lives in Fort Myers, so where the Twins have spring training. So he expressed interest today in a conference call and being a spring training instructor and helping out as well. So I could see him being a guy they add as well, the special assistant. And Glenn Perkins. If Glenn Perkins doesn't pitch next year, right now I think it probably looks that way coming off, the injuries he's had. He's a very smart guy, very into analytics and advanced stats. I think he'd love to try his hand in the front office and kind of learn more about analytics and baseball as well, too. So I do think it's a concerted effort by the front office, and I think we're going to see more and more former Twins that have something to add be added to it.
Yeah, I mean, and how cool would it be for a young Twins player to walk into spring training and there's Jim Cott, there's Justin Morneau, there's Johan Santana. I mean, what a cool thing that is, obviously. And congrats to Johan Santana, as, again, we're talking on this Friday the 19th for his election into the Twins Hall of Fame. Well-deserved, to say the least. So it's been a good week for some former Twins and hopefully for some current Twins as the 2018 season goes on here. Rhett, want to shift gears a little bit. The Twins surprised a lot of people, maybe yourself included, by signing Addison Reed to a 2-year deal. Reed put up good numbers in 2017 between the Mets and the Red Sox following a midseason trade. He's put up good years now for a couple of seasons. Now, the Twins obviously had already signed Fernando Rodney to close. They signed Zach Duke to be in a setup role. Now they bring in Reed Did this kind of surprise you a little bit? Because I think, you know, the consensus was that the Twins were kind of done or close to done in terms of, you know, revamping that bullpen.
It did surprise me. I thought the Twins might add maybe one guy that might be more lower end, like, you know, maybe Matt Belisle on a one-year deal to kind of come back considering the year that he had last year for them and as a leader and guy that kind of wanted to be back. Or maybe some minor league free agents. I didn't think it was going to, you know, a two-year deal after already signing Duke and Robbie. So it did kind of come out of nowhere. But the Twins really like Reed a lot. I talked to, you know, Chief Baseball Officer Derek Salvey, told me they had Reed as one of the top three relievers available even open the offseason. So they really wanted him. And the fact that he was still out there and they got an affordable two-year deal, they couldn't pass it up. They love that idea of having him be kind of that swing man that's going to be able to kind of come in and be that top setup reliever, but come in and get out of jams. They're going to keep Rodney as closer as the plan right now. Of course, things can change in the bullpen, as we all know. But he gives him another, you know, arm that can strike a lot of guys out. He's not a guy that throws really, really hard for a right-hander, but he's a guy that has a great slider, two-pitch guy, but still gets a lot of strikeouts. He's had, you know, good numbers throughout his career. He has some closing experience, which helps in case they need to, you know, shift over from Rodney, who's going to be 40 years old this season. So, yeah, it was a great signing for them. I said, for 2 years to get a guy like that, it's funny, the first two-year contract, or sorry, first multi-year contract the Twins ever given to a free agent reliever. So that kind of tells you in the past, the Twins were never a team that really went out and added relievers via free agency. So it's a big sign for this team. And the bullpen now, I think they're probably done. I think talking to Falvey today, he told me that, you know, barring something small, he doesn't really see too much additions to the bullpen right now.
No, it's interesting to find a guy in Reed that he checks all the boxes. He's a veteran. He has closed, and he has set up. So it's rare to find a guy with all three attributes who's still in the prime of his career. I don't think he's even 30 yet. But he did a great job in front of Craig Kimbrell last year and then before that in front of Jay Arizfamilia with the Mets. So he is certainly comfortable in that role if that is indeed where the Twins slot him for 2018 as the setup guy, the eighth inning guy, ahead of Fernando Rodney. Rhett, can you make a case? This might be a little bit out there, but obviously we've talked about, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks about the Twins' pursuit of a frontline starter, whether that's Darvish, whether that's Arrieta. We don't know where that's going to lead. But do you think that, you know, did the Twins kind of say to themselves, well, if that doesn't happen, we need to fortify the bullpen and beef up the bullpen so that at the very least we can say, you know what, we didn't get the starter we wanted, but we've done a terrific job remaking this bullpen, you know, as kind of a plan B. Is that kind of the thinking as a safeguard for the case that the Twins might not sign that frontline starter?
Well, I talked to Derek Salvey today about that. I asked him specifically, did the signing Reed preclude you at all from any of the top starters in the market? And he said, I even specifically asked about Darvish. And he wouldn't name names, but all he'd say was that it doesn't affect it. And he's still got the Twins still have the budget to sign a top-line starter. He feels like ownership will allow him to do that. They do have a lot of you know, budget flexibility going forward in terms of future years because they don't really have anybody signed a long-term contract. You know, beyond, I think, 2019, they don't have anybody under contract. So if they wanted to, you know, sign a guy like Darvish, they have the budget to be able to do that. So it's certainly a possibility. I still think it might be a little bit more of a long shot, but they're still in on him from what they've been telling me and from what I've been hearing in general. So I think they might be more likely to go after a guy like Cobb or Lynn. But of those top three starters, they're still definitely in that market and trying to find out what's going to happen with them because, you know, as we know, that it's just such a slow-moving market among the starting pitchers that it's hard to know when it's going to kind of start to trickle down or when, what's going to happen here. But the Twins are very confident they're going to add at least one starter. They almost have to in terms of their rotation depth. If they want to compete, they're going to need to add somebody. And obviously they're looking at some mid-tier guys too, but I do think that the signing of Reed, from what he said at least, shouldn't affect their pursuit of any of the starting pitchers that they wanted in the first place.
I mean, what an offseason that would be if you know, they get these bullpen reinforcements and they sign a guy like Darvish, they sign a guy like Cobb or Arrieta. I mean, that would make them a clear offseason winner. Of course, you know, championships aren't won in the winter, but they can be lost. So we'll see what the Twins do or don't do here in the coming weeks. And Rhett, to wrap up here in the final minute or so, we know that there's an ongoing investigation into the alleged misconduct by Miguel Sano back during the 2015 season. Any sort of timetable on when we could see a resolution to this?
Well, Sal, we talked about it a little bit today at Twins Fest. There's really not a full timetable. I think the Twins, from what they've been told by MLB, they'd like to have something done by, you know, spring training, but it's not, or even before the start of the season, but it's not, you know, set in stone. They're still kind of gathering the facts. MLB is the Twins stay out of it other than like little things if they need, you know, but more than anything, it's an MLB investigation. The Twins don't have the power to do anything at all, really, to suspensions or anything. So it's going to be handled by MLB, so the Twins have kind of stayed out of it. And for now, full cooperation, but no real timetable. I think there's a hope from what I've been hearing around the Twins is that it'll be done by spring training in terms of what's going to happen, but the investigation is ongoing, what I've been told.
I know that Miguel is anxious to clear his name, and hopefully that is the resolution to this. Of course, time will tell. Rhett Bollinger, great stuff as always. We thank you for the time. We'll do it again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins.